Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Hey, everybody, this is another episode of Improv Nerd, and I'm Jimmy Crane. Our guest today is Andy Sinclair. He is an alumni of the Second City Main Stage here in Chicago. He's a member of 3033 at I.O. Chicago, and he was the host of Treasure Hunters Roadshow. You've also seen Andy in a ton of commercials in the last couple of years. But before we get to Andy, I just want to share something that happened last weekend. My in-laws came into town. My in-laws are in their 60s, and they're the type of people when they come in to Chicago, they want to see something that's Chicago-like. They like to keep moving. So we ended up going to the Art Institute here, which is a wonderful museum. And I just like to say that I went to the Art Institute because it makes me sound like I've got a lot of culture, which I don't. So we went there, and the first thing we had to do is we had to eat. And my father-in-law wanted to get a cafeteria-style meal. So we went up to the cafeteria. We had a nice meal in the cafeteria. And then after we had lunch, we decided we had to go to the bathroom. So I had to go to the bathroom. Lauren's mom had to go to the bathroom. Lauren had to go to the bathroom. And her father had to go to the bathroom. Now, I've been dating Lauren, known Lauren for probably 3 or 4 years. I'm vague on that. This is the first time I can remember that my father-in-law and I both went to the bathroom together in a public place. So I was really uncomfortable about that. So I went into the bathroom first to kind of scope it out. And when I got there, because he moved slowly, I see that there's two urinals next to each other. But there's no divider. There's no one of those little – a privacy guard, I guess, is what it is. So I said, I'm going to play it safe. There was two stalls. I'm just going to go into one of the stalls and take a pee because that's all I had to do. So I'm taking a pee, and then like 20 or 30 seconds later, her father comes in. And he goes to the stall next to me. And I hear the door close. And then I hear him rip a sheet of one of those protecting things that you put on a toilet that you see in airports and all the really dirty bathrooms that there are. And then then I hear him sit down. And then I hear a couple seconds later, that coming out. And I start to feel really uncomfortable. I start to feel some shame. So I just I finish peeing and I get out of there. And then obviously he took a long time. So maybe 4 or 5 minutes later, I'm sitting on this bench, kind of in shock, really. It was kind of a traumatic experience. He comes out and I just feel weird, we've just shared something really personal and we don't want to talk about it. But I don't even think he cared. I cared. So it took me a while to adjust as we were walking around the museum. This interview with Andy Sinclair, I really, really enjoyed. Andy and I we'd worked together on a team at the I.O. called Carl and the Passions, and it was a great team. It was like a real super team. T.J. Jagodowski was on it, Noah Gregoropoulos, Paul Grandi, Jordan Klepper, Katie Rich, Bill Baylor, just some really, really fine performers. And so Andy in this interview talks about his approach to improvisation, and I've been doing this show for, maybe it's almost 2 years. It'll be 2 years in October. And I interviewed a lot of people. And it was the first time that I'm like, oh, my God, that I made this realization that each improviser has their own process. And Andy talks about how he breaks down a scene very specifically. And also he talks about him being the host of the Treasure Hunters Roadshow and how allegedly that there might have been some scamming going on by the producers. I hope you enjoy this.
Jimmy Crane's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh yeah.
Jimmy's a nerd.
It's so good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You grew up in Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
But you actually said you lived in state parks until you were eight.
Yes.
What was that like?
It was like having a huge backyard, ultimately. Uh-huh. You know, like, my dad's job was, on every state park, there's a house, and in that house, somebody runs that state park.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was young, that was my dad. So we lived in a house on the state park, and then, you know, he was the president of that state park, you know, for lack of a better word.
But I don't ever think of you as an outdoorsy guy.
Yeah. I did that till I'm not actually. I think my dad is almost a little sad about that.
Uh-huh.
Like, I think he was like, I wish you were more outdoorsy. Because
mm-hmm.
I tried hunting and doing all that kind of stuff, and he didn't. Never took from me. I was like, it's fucking 3:00 in the morning. Why are we getting up in the cold?
Right.
I just didn't like that.
You were coming home at 3:00.
Right.
Today.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So it's you know, it's good. It was fun. Like, I could go through caves and all kinds of shit I could do, anything I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So that was fun.
And then you also said you were a big joker and a real smartass when you were a kid.
Yeah.
When did you realize that you liked being in front of people?
Probably when I was 11, 10, you know, like, I think that was, the running joke in my family, I'm not sure if this is true or not, but the first words I ever said were, come on down, you're the next contestant on The Price is Right. And I would hold the garden hose as a mic. And that was like, I used to do that quite a bit. So I guess it was always kind of there, though I never realized that.
But then you go to college and you major in acting.
Yep.
Right? How did that come about?
After about a year and a half. I my first semester in college, I almost flunked out of college because I was from a small town in Missouri, and then I got to college, and I'm like, oh my God, look at all this freedom. I never have to go to class. And that caused, I think.
Were your parents really disciplinarians?
No, not really.
Okay.
My dad, you know, like, I always thought this is the one thing that's helped me choose my current career. I was like, my dad didn't know what he was doing until he was like 29 or 30.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got into his field.
Mm-hmm.
But he told me once, he was like, yeah, I was a Boy Scout leader as a job. I was like, that's not a job, man.
You know, like,
So my first year or two, I got into acting. I just took a class. I took like a general theater 101 class. And I was like, well, I got to pick a major. Yeah, fucking theater. You know, so that's how I...
And what kind of stuff were you doing? Because I don't think of you as a serious actor.
Well, at the time, you know, at that time, I was auditioning for plays. And I did like Taming of the Shrew.
Like, you were into Shakespeare, right?
I was into Shakespeare. I thought that was the coolest thing.
What was cool about Shakespeare?
I thought you could play, and Shakespeare's got, so you can play like really big characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really fun. And so, like, I was a mechanical, I can't think of that play right now. Do you know what that play is? Where the mechanicals are in it? Anybody know that?
It's a Shakespeare play?
Yeah.
Midsummer Night's Dream.
Thank you. Midsummer Night's Dream. That's right. And I you got to play huge characters, and I always thought that was fun. I really always wanted to be Othello. That's what I wanted to be.
Did you ever get the opportunity?
No.
Did you ever come close, like,
no.
Audition?
No, I auditioned for a lot of stuff. When you got to pick a scene in class, I always picked a Shakespeare scene because
mm-hmm.
I just thought they were fun and dumb. And it was like, it was fun to try to learn how to speak like that
mm-hmm.
to me. And compared to other types of, like, plays. I saw the other plays, I just never felt very genuine in it. I never felt like I was like, oh, it's so hot in here. What am I saying? You know, I don't understand. But Shakespeare, I didn't know what I was saying, and that was what made it fun to me.
That's what, when improv really works, to me, that's what goes on, don't you think?
Yeah.
You don't know what you're saying.
Yeah, you're just moving forward.
Right.
And so that's the part of it.
What kind of stuff from Shakespeare and serious acting that you bring into your improv?
Well, I try to do, you know, like, three-dimensional characters, not caricatures.
Mm-hmm. What's the difference for people?
Well, I guess for me, the difference, like, a caricature is just a guy who will just say something just to say something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to use the information that you and I are talking about in a scene to build that character as it goes. So, you know, I can have, like, I can be happy, sad, angry, like, all at one time if I need to be,
mm-hmm.
you know? A caricature, it's just like, oh, I don't believe you. That's, to me, I just don't believe you. And you can sniff that out pretty quick in a scene. You're like, that's not a real person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's for me.
And so then you come to Chicago and you want to be a serious actor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What was your thought? I'm going to be at Steppenwolf or Goodman?
I was just telling Tyler a story. I moved to Chicago in 1998, mm-hmm. around the Taste of Chicago, because that's when I remember that event was going on, so that's around July 4th or 5th. And I had never been to Chicago. I just chose Chicago because in my head I'm like, oh, I have an acting degree. I have to move to one of three places, New York, L.A., or Chicago. And so when I moved to Chicago, I moved there because, one, it was when I was an Ultimate Failure, it was so close to go back to Missouri. It was like 7 hours. I could get there in an hour. And I got an apartment on Addison. Yeah, Addison and closer to the highway or whatever.
So you could really get out of town.
Yeah, down there. So I got an apartment online or through a paper and without ever seeing it. So I get there, and at 1 or 2 days in it, I don't really know what I'm doing. I walk up the street, and I see there's a theater there, and that theater is called I.O. And I walk into that theater, and it happens to be registration for classes. Mm. And they asked me, like, are you here to register for class? And I said, no, I'm not. And I walked out, and I went home, and I called my mom, and she was like, what are you doing? I was like, oh, I just walked into this theater. It's some improv Olympic of some sort. And she was like, are you going to take a class there? And I'm like, no, I didn't really have any money. She's like, I'll give you $200. And I did that, and I took $200, so I went and signed up, and that's how I started taking improv. Now, what I was doing ultimately, though, was a friend of mine was supposed to move with me to Chicago, and he did not. And we were going to start an acting company, and we were going to write plays and write our own material and write and use other material to start to do our own stuff, and he never showed up. So on my second day, I went up.
Whatever happened to that guy?
He now lives here. He's married. He's in an acting company.
And then when you're at I.O., you're in level one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and your class becomes a team.
Yes.
It becomes People of Earth.
Yes.
So here you are, and I for the people to understand this, because mm-hmm. I started in the 80s, the 80s, where you'd be in the first level and you would be on a team.
Right.
Okay. But when you started,
right.
that was unheard of.
Right. It was one of those times where Sharna would say, like, she'll do this from, and she probably still does from time to time. She'll see a team, a couple, like, older teams, whatever, whoever they are, and she's like, no, I'm going to cut them. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put all young, new faces on a show. And you're like, okay. But she never does it. Ultimately, she never does it. But that one time in 1998, she did it. And all of us from our class, like, there was probably 15 people in the class, 10 of us or 9 of us from that class got on to the... And it was mind-blowing, because when she said it, we were like, never expecting it. And then she actually did it. And in that class, like, me and Danny Mora, Bill Arnett, and Alex Findrich, Dave Hill, Bobby Mort, Jason Pardo, that team became People of Earth. Mm-hmm. And Peter Gwynn was our coach.
And you got, and you say that Peter was a big influence.
Yes.
How was he?
He's probably outside of like Noah, he's probably my biggest influence in improv. Well, because, you know, he, at that time, you know how the city is and everybody does it. Is that you get really wrapped into your own thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you want to do this and you want to do it. And I think Peter kind of maybe felt a little burned that he didn't get the main stage
right.
at that time. So I think he went to Sharna and was like, go give me 8 or 9 people that really want to do improv, and I will turn them into robots, improv robots. And that's what he did. And we rehearsed every week. So in 1 week of, you know, of my first year, I would do this during the week. I would, whatever my job was, then I had to go to a class at I.O., and then I rehearsed with Peter for 3 weeks, and then we had a show. That's minimum what I was doing my first year. I mean, there could have been other shows, or I might have been taking another class.
So how big of an advantage of it was it that you were taking class and getting to perform at the same time when you didn't have much experience of improv?
It was the best, because I was terrible. I mean, I didn't.
When people say terrible, give me an example of how terrible you were.
I remember this one scene that I did with Dave Hill, and he was wearing a T-shirt. It was an orange T-shirt that had looked like a sun, kind of looked like an eye. And I would be like, gosh. Sorry, I did your laundry. I just washed your orange shirt with an eye on it. I mean, I was literally just whatever I saw on you. And I was like, oh, I'm bad.
And you know, the blue pants was an initiation.
Yeah. And I would, you know, and that's what makes Gwyn, you know, really good, was that he stuck with me, you know, and he didn't, and the guy stuck with me. And that's very important to me. Like those, that's probably why I, when I come to town, I still, they're my dearest, dearest friends, because those guys, I was not good for a long time. And I was always afraid they were going to be like, get him out of here.
Would you say you have a more connection with those guys than people that you did shows at Main Stage? Because I feel like the I.O., for some right. reason, it, well, to no me, it was like college.
Yeah, you know, like the Main Stage guys and ETC guys, it's a different kind of connection. You know, like Brad and I are very close.
Brad Morris.
Mm-hmm, they're very close. And a few other people, Emily Wilson. But like Danny and Alex, they've seen me at your worst. I mean, they literally have seen me at my worst. They used to make fun of me because in every scene I was always the buddy. So it didn't matter who you were playing. You could have been the president, and I'd be like, the president's buddies hanging out. Because I didn't know any better, and that's how I would hide. I would hide, be like, whatever. You'd be like, so, you know, we got to get this bill passed. You know it, man. You know, like, that's how I would hide.
You know, Pete, I love that you talk about this, because I believe that I still hide in improv. And can you explain what hiding in improv meant to you? Because I think people don't understand. They're like, you're up there and you're in front of people, but when you're working with eight people, mm-hmm. you can hide.
Yeah, well, in that show, too.
You people know, of Earth, you're talking about.
Yeah, People of Earth, those guys, like, that's aggressive. That was all dudes. That's mm-hmm. an aggressive.
You got a lot of testosterone, a lot of edits.
And it's an aggressive group of men, mm-hmm. and they still are. You know, like, and those guys still are. Now we've chilled out, as we've gotten older, chilled
sure.
out a little more.
Losing our testosterone levels have gone down.
Yeah, so that time, if it was get on the stage and fucking attack and mm-hmm. grab that audience by the neck and don't let them go. I mean, we used to have, and I probably shouldn't even say this, but we Gwyn made a board, a huge board, for our rehearsal space, and we rehearsed at Danny and Bill's space a lot. And on this board was a bullseye, and inside this, all these bullseyes was every fucking team on the schedule. And what we did, whenever we thought we were better than them, we scratched them off the list. And, like, we were fucking animals that way. Like, we would go to watch your show and be like, yeah, we're fucking better than you. And then we'd go in. And so
that's what I like about Peter Gwynn. He's not competitive.
Yeah. I mean, I would never do that.
No.
I would never in my life.
I may just think it.
Yeah.
Or talk
sure.
about it at the bar, but I would never have. I'd never leave evidence.
No, he did. And Danny and Bill left it up in their house when they went together. It was always up because, you know, like in the center was whoever we thought was the greatest team at IO. Was it
the family then?
No, it was like Georgia Pacific.
Okay, which you had Jack McBrayer and TJ on it. Yeah.
Eventually, we scratched all the names off. You know, I don't know if it's probably, they were probably better, but it's ridiculous. But
did anyone ever get drunk and just scratch one off just in like a drunken?
No. Okay. Danny and Bill, they kept that, you know.
Like in a glass case.
Yeah. Oh, that's very important to those guys.
They probably still have it.
Yeah. I bet Danny wishes he would have that somewhere. I mean, it's pretty funny. But,
right.
But that's what, you know. Thing about Peter, that's what made Peter so good. He knew that would take with those group of guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I would never do that, but he was right. And we loved it. And I'm sorry to answer your question about hiding.
Yeah.
Hiding is, when that team was so aggressive, you can just kind of, I would just kind of come out and like occasionally tell a joke and be like, oof, and then get out. I would never start anything mm-hmm. to me. I would try to fill.
You know, you talked about characters, and the one thing that, you said that your go-to character is the asshole coach.
Right.
Okay. Why do you like playing that character?
I like playing. I just think playing an asshole is because I probably do it with a little bit of a twinkle or a wink in my eye, where I'm like, I can say anything I want, because I would never say this to you in general, mm-hmm. you know. So like, this is just my time to do that, and you know, I like. Being mean in some ways kind of fun on stage.
Was it because like for me it's like I'm really nice in life, and like I like to be angry on stage because I have a hard time being angry in life? Is it something like that?
It maybe, you know, like I feel like being like an asshole on stage, it's because I think that's what people want to see too.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, and it's to me it's a character. Mm-hmm. It's a different kind of whether I'm like. I mean, because you can settle all your characters down to a pretty basic, like, this is my dumb guy, this is my asshole, this is the very excited kid.
Right.
You know, I also have, like, these three characters that are kind of the same, which is, like, a sassy black secretary, gay guy and southern guy. Like those are kind of like, you're like, hey y'all, how you doing? And he's like, it's one of those three. I just got to figure out who it is, you know. But the asshole character is fun just because you get to do, it's just different.
And how did you develop those six characters you just named? How did those come about? Take one of them.
You know, like for me, for like anytime I play women, mm-hmm. and I do like to play women mm-hmm. on stage, like I just think it's all characters come from fun. Like, what's my enjoyment out of this thing? You know, if I can say it at a pretty reasonable rate, it's high, then I'm interested.
But do you, like, you're in a restaurant and you see somebody, a woman, she's a waitress or she's eating dinner or something like that, and she's got an attitude. Do you take that, or where does the inspiration
come
from?
Well, in different places, you know, like, it's like if you're writing it for Second City, my first thought is, who am I talking to? Like,
meaning the audience.
Yeah,
the
but who
demographic?
Are they? No, who are they? As in, like, is it a basketball team? Like what? Because I have all these people in Second City in the room. They're already in the room. I'm not just going to talk to them like they're audience members. I'm going to give them a character. And their character is this. They're at this seminar. They are trying to vote for something. You know, like, it's a halftime of a basketball game. And they have to listen to me. I want them to be forced to listen to me. So that always is how I almost start. With
so you cast the audience as a second character.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I work backwards. And for me, what really helps me a lot is like a catchphrase to get me started.
Well, give me an example.
Like I did a character called Coach on the ETC, and it was a halftime of eight-year-old basketball game. But he would always start with like Jesus Christ. And then that gets me going. Then I'm like, I'm off. Now I'm off to the races, you know.
So when you get the Jesus Christ, that puts you in the what happens then in your head? That like you...
Bigger. That's what happens in my head. Immediately. Bigger, bigger, bigger.
Bigger, bigger, bigger what? The character?
Everything. Yeah, more.
Because it's so funny when your work is so grounded.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, how do you balance that?
Well,
because it is, your stuff is believable.
Right. Right, I think that's because, you know, like if with something like Coach, for example, that character, which I just did this, I did it the other day in L.A. for a showcase, so it's very fresh right now because I'm like, how did I used to do that? You know, like, but yeah, I think I just wanted. That's the thing is I want it to be believable. I want to show you I can go really huge, but yet you're buying it, and that I think that's interesting to me. Just for me to come out and be like, just stand up and be like, hey guys, here's what we're doing. You know, everybody's going to be like, what's going on? You
right.
Know, just like slow, patient, big character. That's what I like.
That big?
Yeah. For me, a lot of them are big. Like if they put together like a Second City greatest hits of whatever, which would be awful. But, you know, there's going to be tons. I'll never play Andy. I always play like a bigger character.
Mm-hmm. But it's funny, the success you've got since you've been out in L.A. Uh-huh. has been Andy.
Yes.
I mean, what is the Treasure Hunt Road Show?
Right.
The Walmart stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, stuff on Cougars. It's all been you.
Yes, which is crazy. But I think that's because people that are staying in Chicago for a long time and go out to L.A. are well-cooked. You're good actors. I've done a lot of auditions out there where the lady will end, she's like, I haven't met you yet. Where are you from? They're like, I'm from Chicago. She's like, I knew it. You know, that happens a lot. Mm-hmm. That happens way more.
Well, what did you have to adjust when you were out there? Because, I mean, it's...
Well, what you do realize eventually is that people in L.A. are fucking terrible. A lot of them are not good. A lot of them are not good actors. Mm-hmm. You know, like, a lot of them are like 23 to 27-year-old people who are just like I was in Chicago. You know, I was 23 to 27 trying to figure it out. I didn't know what I was doing. So Chicago gives you a... And I know it's completely biased because I love Chicago, but it gives you, it cooks you. There's so many more opportunities here and it helps and it helps and it helps. And that's what makes it better in LA.
The other thing that I've always loved about you is you're always having fun on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And I reached out to Dina Fackless because
mm-hmm.
you've performed with her before. And,
yeah.
And she said you're never in your head.
Right.
And it's always about fun.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get to that point?
Well, I guess I figured like if I'm... Why else would I be doing it? You know, like...
Money, fame?
Yeah, that's...
Okay.
Those would be great.
Yeah.
But I just think that it really is amazing to me that people come to the show. Even this, you know, like, people are just, why are they here? You know, like, or why do they go to I.O.? Why do they go see improv that, you know, 60, 70% of the time could be hot garbage, you know? But they do, and they come, and it's just a neat thing to me. So I think it's really funny. It's like a trick. We're all playing on each other. So I enjoy that. I enjoy doing that and seeing people, seeing, like, what's Jimmy? I don't know. This is, what's he doing? It's unbelievable. He said that. It's so dumb. You know, like, I did a workshop today, and the first two lines of this one scene were like, this lady, I can't believe you're real. And I hope she hears this because she'll be excited. Then the second, the guy said that, and then the girl goes, and you're not retarded. And I was like, I love it. I don't know what that means. That scene I can't figure out at all. But I love it. I just love that thing.
What do you love? That they can't figure it out at the top of the scene?
Yeah, I love that it's two sentences that never should go together. Mm-hmm. To me.
And they'll eventually make it work.
Yeah, at some point. You know, it might take 25 minutes, but they'll get it figured out at some point.
Yeah. All right, so we're going to figure it out because we're going to do some improv.
Cool.
Okay? So all we're going to take a suggestion and we're just going to do scenes. Do you have anything... For me, do you have anything? I'd like to start and do characters with you.
Okay.
Do you have any suggestions?
No.
For me?
No. Because I feel like whatever your character is going to start with, it will probably influence how I move to it a little bit.
Okay, because I just do more attitude than I do character.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, so we just need a suggestion to start.
Mayflower.
I feel like this boat cruise is probably the one we should do.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's got a pool.
Yeah, I mean most of them are gonna have a pool on there. Is that how you're judging the cruises?
Yeah, by a pool.
By a pool?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's gonna have a cruise on it. Okay. I don't know. That's a good one. Oh boy, here we go.
Oh yeah.
Here we go.
Oh yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah.
They got bands on there.
Look at you eat four times a day.
Four times.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Breakfast, lunch, and then there's an evening snack.
Yeah, the snacker.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I kind of like that one.
Yeah, let's just give it a shot.
Yeah.
You want to put that in there? Get your cell phone on you?
Yeah, I got it right here.
You want to give him a call or?
Yeah.
You want to call him?
Yeah. I need a number.
Yeah, I'll say about that.
Yeah.
1.
Okay.
8. 0. 0. 7. 9. 5.
Did you say 5?
Yep, 5.
Yeah.
5.
5?
Yeah, 7, 9, 5.
5, 5? Okay.
There's 1, 5. It's 7, 9, 5.
Okay, I got to start over.
Okay, yeah, start that over. Ready? Over here.
Right.
1.
Okay.
8. 0.
0.
0.
I said 0. Yeah.
Just, okay. Are you doing the zeros? Or are you doing that?
I'll do the zero. I got the zero.
I'm going to rattle off these numbers.
I'm just start again. Okay. I got the 1 because.
You respond to my ones and then we'll know.
Okay.
Then I'll know.
Okay.
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 1.
1.
There you go.
Okay.
8. 0.
0. I got the 2 zeros.
Don't jump. This is, once you jump, this is like big trouble. Okay. 0.
There's another 0?
No, that's 1800.
Okay,
zero.
I gotta start over.
Yeah, okay. I can make the phone call. You're still rocking that flip?
Yeah, I got that.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's nice.
You know, you can drop this. I dropped this. You can drop it right in the water and it.
The protection?
Yeah, I got that protection. It's like $5 a month, but it's worth it. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
You get internet on that thing?
Yeah, you get like half internet.
Half internet?
Yeah,
like
that.
Some of it's a little, like, it just is good. The bar goes to here?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What are you paying for that?
I think they threw that in.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes more sense.
All right. Okay.
1.
1.
8.
8.
What's your minutes like on that thing? Like, you get a lot of minutes?
It's unlimited minutes and unlimited texts.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's nice. Yeah. That's nice. That's nice. Yeah. Why never upgrading? Why did you never upgrade?
I'm just comfortable with this, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't like to change, you know?
I know what you mean.
Yeah, yeah.
I was against Obama.
I know. Yeah.
One.
What do you... What's your thought on gay marriage?
No thanks.
Okay. You know?
It's not for me.
Okay.
I'm not against the gays in general.
Right.
But I don't, you know, you... no thanks. I mean, they got restaurants, they got...
Parades.
Parades, they got a neighborhood or two. Right. You guys got enough.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. All right.
You want struggle, go see 42.
42?
The Jackie Robinson.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay.
That's struggle.
Okay, I got to start over because it took too long.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a time-sensitive thing here.
Does it go dark? It
goes dark. It's for security purposes.
Smart. You got a code on there?
Yeah, I put it in every morning, change the code.
Change the code every morning?
You won't get identity theft with this.
Right, but why every morning? How do you remember, how do you keep the numbers straight in that thing?
I just, I write them down. And I pen
every morning?
Yeah, and then I shred it. I have a shredder.
That's like,
you should get a shredder.
No, nobody
you
needs
should,
a shredder.
I told you, you should get a shredder.
Nobody needs a shredder.
We need a shredder.
No, why would I?
You know what's going to happen? Somebody's going to use your debit card. They're going to put $40 on gas at Shell, and you're going to go. I don't know. I didn't do this because you don't have a car. And then they're going to get into your other personal stuff.
Why? They can go. They don't have hardly any money anyway. It's fine. They can say one.
That's see, the people that need it most are the people that have the less money. That's why I have it.
But if let's just say a cop comes into your house, you're going to look like a madman with a paper with just billions of numbers on it.
Like I said, I shred them before they come.
No, thank you.
All right.
No, thank you.
Abortion.
What? How do I feel about abortion?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not against it. I'm not for it either. I mean, I don't... I think in general, if it's there, they can do what they want to do. And I don't have that same theory about the gays, though.
All right. Stem cell.
Are you for... I don't even understand stem cell, to be honest with you. I don't get what it does.
Well, it's...
Where does it come from?
It comes from the stem of the cell.
Correct. Where is that?
They go and they find people's stems, and then that's how they do it.
Is it inside your body?
Yeah, it's a total inside job, yeah.
Pretty good movie.
Inside Job?
Yeah, not bad. Not bad.
Was that one with, who was in that movie?
Yeah, I think that Clive guy, right?
Yeah.
Clive, it's not Clive Davis, that's a different man.
No, but if I had a smartphone, I could check.
Yeah.
But now I can't.
Right.
Because I only got half the internet.
Well, maybe the first half of his name will pop up if you get close.
Okay.
Don't worry. Why, I want to ask, are you for or against abortion?
I'm for abortion.
Right. Are you for or against stem cell?
I'm for stem cell.
So you're just trying to get me to bat some out there, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because, you know, I've never known your political views. And if we're going to go on a cruise together...
Right. We may not be compatible.
Right.
Right.
Because we're going to be sharing a cabin together, and it's pretty small.
Okay.
And I don't want to be, like, sleeping there, and then you're yelling out things, I hate black people, let's say. You know?
Right.
That would scare me.
Right, I wouldn't yell that out.
No.
Cabin.
No. Yeah. Right.
Nah, who knows what can be... No way.
Right.
Okay.
I'm just saying.
Right. Okay, well then how... What do you feel about, like... What's your food preference?
I like...
Yeah, I'll name a group, a kind of food, and you'd be like, yes or no.
Okay, great.
Greek.
I'm not for it.
Saying yes.
You're saying yes?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Italian.
I'm for it.
I say no.
You do?
I say no, not interested.
Not at all?
Nah, it's too carby.
Okay. All right, I'm going to throw one out at you.
Okay.
Okay. Vegetarian.
Absolutely not.
Me neither.
Yeah, okay, well, there we go.
We got meat. Right.
Okay.
We got meat.
Pork chop.
Depends how it's cooked.
I'm going to say yeah.
You're going to say yes? What if it's just raw served on a plate?
Well, no, then I'm leaving the restaurant.
Okay.
What about like a T-bone?
I'd say yes.
Okay, I'll say yes too.
Really?
I thought
if you like pork chop, you'd definitely go with the T-bone.
Yeah, that was my thought too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like the pork chop. I'm going to like the T-bone.
Okay.
Okay. What about, like, what do you have a... Like a music preference? In the morning, I like to get up and put on music.
Yeah, I do too. I like to do a little stretching in the morning, yeah. I like Prince.
In the morning, you're
like Purple Rain, like his earlier stuff.
Right, right. I mean, that's the Prince is still good, but yeah, his early stuff is where it's at.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
Purple Rain, Raspberry Beret,
red,
yeah.
Little Red Corvette.
Little Red Corvette.
When Doves Cry.
Yeah, I love that one. That is so underrated.
That is underrated.
Yeah. A lot of people think, you know, that's a chick song, but no.
No. No. I don't understand it, but it's not a chick song.
No, I don't either.
It's a universal.
Here's the thing. People think because it's got doves in it, right, it's a chick song. But
yeah.
Ozzy Osbourne, he was biting the heads off doves and throwing them on off stage.
So it's more manly.
It's more manly, you know?
Right. So you're rocking Prince in the morning.
Right.
Okay.
I had a girlfriend once who accused me of being gay because I liked that song.
What? Why?
Yeah.
Who? Which one?
Belinda. Remember? The real fat one?
Yeah, the real fat. I could never call her that, but yeah, she was a bitch. She wasn't real fat. She was just like a little overweight.
Yeah, like... Yeah, she was like, well, you never saw her with her clothes off.
Nope, no thank you.
It was not good.
Yeah, well, you know, we all go through her.
She had a crush on you.
What?
Yeah, that's why I broke up with her.
Well, she's got good taste.
Yeah. You never gave her the time of day.
No. No, I don't like redheads. That's my thing.
Well, she's not a natural redhead.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Because it's really red. It was really red.
Dyed. It's all dyed. Down there, it's a whole different story.
Darkish? Or lightish?
Lightish.
No. Lightish, it's like blonde pubes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those are going to gray quickly.
Yeah. That was really fun. Hey, Emily? How long was that?
3 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
That was great.
Nice.
That was really fun.
Yeah.
Okay, that was a great character you did.
Oh, thank you.
How what was that based on?
I think for me, just the voice. You know, like that was... And eventually, you know, I caught my catchphrase in there, eventually.
What was your catchphrase?
For me, it was easy when I said, no, thank you. That was the one. I did it early, and then and it got a laugh, and that cued me in. That for me.
So a lot of people are like, "Oh, you got to listen to your partner." But what I'm hearing is, you also have to listen to the audience.
I do. I think so. I don't listen to them but I think the audience will give you what your scene is sometimes.
In that case, it was they were laughing at that catchphrase,
and I caught it, and I caught them. I was like, "No, thank you," and got a laugh. And it could have been also the way that whatever that joke was got set up.
Uh huh.
But then. Then I said it again, and I said it two or three more times. And by the third time, I think the audience was like, I guess this is what he's going to fucking say.
Right.
You know, and so I kind of dragged them, I forced them to come with me. I'm like, no, I'm going to keep saying this. Come on. You know, and I drag them with me.
Right. I didn't have a character.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was just going off you, because
right,
you were kind of this guy. And I'm like, okay, I'll just kind of mirror his energy.
Right.
You know?
Well, I didn't know if it was like, are we two gay guys going on a cruise together, or are we...
I thought we were just two buddies. Two buddies,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But at the top, I wasn't sure.
Okay.
You know, I didn't know.
And how did you come up with, because I was totally lost, excuse me for spitting, I was totally lost at the beginning, mm-hmm, you took Mayflower, mm-hmm, and you went right to the environment, which was, for the people that are listening on the right podcast, you went right to the travel agent, and there was brochures on the wall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How did you come up with that idea?
Well, I just, for me, when I start a scene, in general, I get the suggestion, I will almost try to do something at the top. Because if not, I used to find I had a real bad habit of, I'll just stare at you, mm-hmm, and I will wait, mm-hmm, and you and I will finally start talking. So I just want to do something. Also, because what I'm trying to do is read what your body is doing.
And what was my body telling you?
Well, to tell me at the top, it was a little frantic. And you were kind of like, so that cued me off of we're trying to decide on something.
Okay.
And it wasn't, you weren't even frantic. You were just kind of pacing about just a little bit.
Because
I think listening is not just with your ears, it's also with your eyes for me.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can see with these, I can see what you're doing, I can listen to how you're standing, sitting, moving. Mm-hmm.
And then, as we were doing it, I felt, as we were going longer, I felt comfortable. These guys could, it wasn't really about plot, it was just about these guys kind of riffing on stuff in their lives.
Yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to set up plot. I want to, in the top.
You want to what?
I will set up plot. And we got to pick where we're going.
So, give me an example of this scene where the plot was. for you?
Would have been the very first line. What I'm trying to do is set it up, and then I want to do everything in the world not to do it.
Okay, so give me an example. So
it was like, we've got to pick one of these boats.
Okay, so it was basically, the plot was, we got to decide where we're going to go, what cruise, and then you just let that go.
Yeah, and I don't want to deal with it. That's a lot of 30-33 is as well, which is we try to set up something, and then we try to force ourselves not to do it. We want to do anything but that. So, like, there it is. This is what, you know, like, if you give that line to, let's say, a beginning level one student, like, your opening line is, we've got to pick a boat, right, or take a boat. They're going to talk about a fucking boat for 5 minutes.
Right.
I don't want to do that. I want to set that up and then just run away from it.
And what does that do to free you up when you do that?
To free me up about?
By putting plot into the first line, how does that free you up then? Because, like you were saying, young people are going to go into, or young improvisers are going to go, we got to pick a boat, and we're going to talk about a boat. But to me, you're throwing that out to free you up to go to relationship. Is that right?
Right. Just so you know, so like, hey, this is what the scene's about, and then I'm out of there.
They're okay.
Like, I'm not doing that. I'm not going to talk about this thing. And plot's probably not the right word, but
premise
probably more the right word. Like, this is where we can start. But it tells me more about the character. As I was saying in a workshop, to me, a scene is, I want it to be like a camera just comes in and catches us and then goes back to another scene. So, like, the people at home just happen to, like, oh, interesting, we're flipping the channel. Look at these two guys are trying to go on a boat. Oh, man, why are they talking about Obama and stem cell? Like, those sort of things interest me.
Right. Well, that was kind of a slice of life scene, didn't you say?
And those are what I like.
Yeah, I do too. Mm-hmm. Okay, we've got some people here. We'd like to ask some questions.
Please.
Great. So we could turn the lights up and ask. We've got some questions of what we just did, or to Andy in general.
Yeah.
So how? Yeah, Tom.
Yeah, Andy, I want to ask. You don't really overanalyze things a lot.
Right.
You just kind of do them. At what point did you find yourself just being in a moment and stop overthinking things?
Probably, 5 or 6 years ago, more of when, I think the one good thing about Second City is, there's a lot of good things about Second City, but one of the things that they do well is they give you the chance to fail. And once you can start failing at a pretty fine, big rate and you know it's okay to fail, then you just don't care. And then you're like, great. You know, like, let's go out and do this for me. Mm-hmm.
Great. Let's take another question.
I'm going through Six at Conservatory right now, Second City.
Mm-hmm.
What can you say about the act of re-improvising a scene? Coming in with a basic premise or a one-sentence structure, playing it once, and then having to return to it later and refine those, rediscover.
So, like, it's something that's already written? Ultimately, like, you improvised it. And
I guess anything that falls into the realm of re-improvisation. Trying to find lightning in a bottle twice.
Well, you know, that's what ultimately you end up doing at Second City when you write a show. Like, for me, what always works is get to a certain point in your script that you like, the first page or two, get it to a certain point, and then just don't write anymore. And then improvise. You know, and then what you're going to do, obviously, is take whatever you did and then go back in there and just try to find one single joke. And you find that one joke and put that in your script. And then you build that way. Just be willing to say to yourself, if I get one joke out of this, that's fantastic. Because if you can't try to keep going back in and you're like, I don't know why they're not buying this cat character. You know, nobody's going to give a shit after a while. And you won't either. You're just going to be like, meow, here I am. You know, it's over. And it's done. So you just need one joke. Snipe, sniper, sniper. That's good.
Great. Another question? Yes.
You were just talking about how you maintain characters. If you play a big character with a catchphrase or something like that. What other tricks or tips do you, for yourself, to maintain a large character throughout the entire scene without turning back into Andy?
Well, I would, for me, like to keep character going, catchphrase is right, the first thing, again, of course, that pops in my head, but, you know, it's the way he moves, the way he walks. Like, I caught myself even this, I think I had my hand on my hip a few times, like, those sort of things, like, the way, how does this person move, stand, hold?
Wait, what? What are you talking about? Like those little nuances for me, because I don't really sit around and be like, wait, what? I don't sound like that or talk like that too much. So like those, it's just the little things that can bleed out.
Now, was that a character you had done before?
Probably over at some point in my life, but I can't remember a recent time doing it. I like that kind of like dumb, big dumb guy. I like those kind of characters too. So,
like, who had the higher status in that scene?
I don't know. That's a good question. I felt like at the start maybe it was me, and then I think when you started peppering those like abortion so and so, I was like, all right, Jimmy's higher status. I can drop down to my comfortable low status.
Really? Do you play? Because that's my that's my wheelhouse. I in life and on stage.
Yeah.
How do I would never have thought that you like playing low status characters.
I do, and even my high status characters are just dumb guys. You know, like, they're just dumb guys who happen to somehow made their way to the top of the insurance pile or whatever they're doing. You know.
So we got another question here.
Yeah, in relation to a sketch comedy review, Second City, as a writer-performer, what's the relationship you like with the director?
At Second City, for example? Or
doing that type of show.
Well, I don't. I never liked the director. I mean, I do love the director, but I never liked the director.
You had said, too, that you when you started to work with Mick Napier, you were terrified of him.
Yeah, I was a little afraid of Mick, only because of... Well, I mean... That show, I did the 50th, and that was a big show for Second City, so there was a lot of outside pressure that didn't need to be on.
At Second City, they were doing outside pressure?
Well, as in, like, it's the 50th.
Yeah, it's really?
So I think, in general, with the directors, everybody, it's a dance you deal with in the first, especially the first few weeks, you know? They're going to let you do whatever you want for most of the time, but the last 2 or 3 weeks, they're going to really want to button it down, and which is good, and that's why they exist. But I for me, directors are necessary, and I've had actually some of the great directors who let me do whatever I want, like Jim Carlson or Hovde or some of those guys, and Mick. So it's like I just don't want them to mess. Don't talk to me in general about what's going on in my scene. I know it sucks. You know how I know it sucks? Because nobody laughed. Like, so don't tell me.
So what do you want a director to do for you? I mean, to get the best out of
funnel me towards something. You know, like...
Don't come in and say, you know, that scene sucked.
Right, I know it sucked. I want to get rid of it, too.
Right.
You know, because it sucked.
You want somebody to come in and say, if you did this, why don't you try that?
Yeah, like, hey, that, you know, you keep hitting that same beat. I know you love it, but is it really worth it? Because I don't tend to go short. I tend to go long. So, I like, you can start me on, like, this has got to be a 5-minute piece. I'm like, you got it. And then you look at your clock and it's like, was that 8.5 minutes? You know, like, because I want to get in there and I want to stay. Like, till the lights go down, I'm like, there's got to be another laugh. Got to be another laugh. I know there is. I just need one thing. So I need directors to funnel me down a little bit.
Great.
Sure, directors hate that.
One more question? Yeah.
When you were working on the Treasure Hunter Roadshow, was a lot of that improvised, or was it really scripted out, or how does that go?
Well, that show, you know, the people I worked with or for it was very nice. Now, that company itself was a disaster. They were just rich hillbillies, openly. So what would happen is we went to 22 different cities over the course of the year, every other week, ultimately, until they ran out of money, because I don't know why, but... I do.
We got no more money. We gambled it. Yeah. We lost it.
I think the lead guy, the main guy, was fucking some other chick, and I think his wife wanted a divorce and just took all his money. I think that's actually what happened. And I think they were kind of ripping people off a little bit. It was a weird thing to go to. I would go to this road show in general.
What were the people like?
Well,
I mean, there had to be some sadness there.
Yes. I'll tell you exactly what happened on that Treasure Hunter Roadshow. Probably some of you, most of you don't even know what it is. But like it was all improvised, interviewing with people. And I had never hosted a show for it, and I never understood what that means. You know, like somebody like Ryan Seacrest, for example, he's really good at his job. I can tell you that, you know, like after doing it. But the Treasure Hunter Roadshow itself was, You would take people would bring whatever they brought, their antiques or whatever, and they would take it to this place that was normally in a big basketball arena. It'd be like I was at what's the place by Soldier Field? McCormick?
Yeah, McCormick Place.
So like that's where it would be held, basically. And so a bunch of people would go, and the deal was Treasure Hunters Roadshow, the company, would pay you actual money. So you could leave. You could be like, I have this old table. We'll give you $100 for it. And you would walk out with money. And that's the deal. The problem is they know the price, whatever they set that price is. And
so who knows the price?
There's people behind on in the black shirts. This is Treasure Hunt Roadshow. They have a computer, and they would be like, yeah, this is the 1940s baseball card. It's probably worth about 30. We'll give you 30 for it, and they'll sell it.
Okay.
So it's
some people would sell it then.
Yeah, there's three kinds of people that would sell stuff in general, and it's somebody who is older and is afraid of their computer and is afraid of the internet. And they also somebody who thinks like not a flea market, but like when you go to trade, you know, what's a building that you like a I can't think of. You would like, hey, I want to sell them my gold here, and then they would buy it.
Like one of those gold, like a pawn shop.
A pawn shop. Yeah. Pawn shops have bad names. That's right. The other thing. Like you don't. I mean, you know this, but if you think I'm going to go to this pawn shop, your first thought is they're going to rip me off.
Right.
And the second is the third kind is that somebody. Their loved one has passed away, and they're selling their stuff, and that's those are the three kinds of people. And you know, I wanted to quit after the first week because I thought they were ripping people off, and some of them do or were, and some of them are nice.
How did you figure out they were ripping the people off?
Well, because sometimes they'd brag. They would be like afterwards. They would be like, oh man, I got this sweet, you know, table and. I got it for like $100. I saw online it was worth $3,000. I was like, couldn't get them $1,500. You know, you wouldn't give them half of that. Because what they do is how they buy it is they get on the phone and they call someone who they know will buy it from them immediately. Now it takes a month or two to get that shit to them, but they're like, okay, yeah, that's what this is. Hang on, I'm gonna call. Like, they have a guy who does wood or a guy who does memorabilia and a guy who does so and so, and they would call their guys. You're like, yeah, we got this. You'll take it? Okay, how many? Oh, I'll sell it to you for $3,000. Great. Okay. I'll buy that off you for $400.
So they had it sold before the show was even over?
Before it's over. They have it. They most of the time, they try to sell or have most of it sold.
Now, before moving out to L.A., you left Second City.
Mm-hmm.
And you're one of the few people that didn't leave bitter or angry. Because mm-hmm. a lot of people stay way too long. Mm-hmm. And then they feel like, oh, Saturday Night Live didn't get me or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Where's mine? How did you leave in such good spirits?
Well, I loved it. You know, I mean, I loved it. I think I came into this improv world through the back door a little bit. So everything was gravy to me. I mean, I know so many people who are way more talented, in my opinion, than me that don't ever get that opportunity. So like this, I get this opportunity. I'm just going to stay and enjoy it. It's like you're a comedy rock star. Like you get when you tour, you get to stop in a place and they laugh and then you leave. And you're like, what? That's fucking crazy. Now I'm going to stay at a hotel. And that's always enjoyable to me. And then, you know, like you do the ETC or the main stage. You know, I did Las Vegas and I lived there for 7 months.
Well, you like to gamble, right?
Yeah, that was terrible. I had to get out of there.
Did you lose money?
All the time. Okay. I think that's why they hired me back for ETC because they're like, let's save Andy's life.
How much were you into the casinos?
At all, my first day of work on writing a show, for Second City, my first Second City show I ever wrote for, I stayed up to like 9 o'clock drinking, 9 a.m. drinking and gambling, and then I had to be at rehearsal at 11 with a 3-page idea, like a script. So I went home at 9, wrote down a 45-minute idea, showed up at 11, and got the show. And stay in the show the whole time. And I was like, well, this is easy. You know, I just got lucky.
But did you get the thousands of dollars?
Yeah, you know, until I got to broke. I mean, I had to call my mom a couple times to be like crying on the phone and like make a like kind of a half-ass excuse.
Did you think you might have had a problem with gambling?
Yes. My problem is once I get in there, I will grind and I'll never leave. That's my problem. Like, I'll just sit at the table. I'll just stay there. I love it.
And what's your relationship with gambling now?
I try not to go. You know, I try not to get into it. I went a couple weeks ago for an hour, and I think I lost like $500. I was like,
I can't go. I can't go back. So I go. I just go for a little while, but I try not to go.
So leaving Second City with this, you just felt
honored to be a part of that fraternity, and I still do, and I still love that place, and you know, it's like the biggest family in the world. That you know, my cousins and my nephews and my nieces that are there that were before me and that will become after me. I'm just proud to say that that place took me in and was nice enough to make me a better performer.
And now you're in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and you live with Brad Morris and his wife for 4 months.
My first 4 months out there, yeah.
And how do you, like for me, I never like to stay with people.
Mm-hmm.
How did you do it and not feel like you were a burden?
I did feel like I was a burden, but I think...
What did you do to compensate for that?
I tried to tell a lot of jokes in the house. Like, but Marnie's a lawyer, so she's gone a lot, and she uh-huh. works her ass off. And so it was a lot of Brad and Andy time. To like 7 or 8 at night, and that was a lot of fun. You know, they had an extra room. They still call it Andy's room.
Mm-hmm.
So even when Brad's gonna have twins, so even when those twins are born, I'm like, is they gonna be in my room? And Brad's like, no, that's still your room. I'm like, yeah. Okay, good. So yeah, I always felt like a burden. I think they made me pay them, and they didn't make me pay them anything. I got them like a $150 gift card at a restaurant. That was my payment for letting me stay for 4 months. It's a pretty good deal by me. That's like $33 a month.
And how did that help you with the transition to L.A.?
You know, L.A. is such a big and weird place that it's nice to have someone to talk to about everything. And Brad was good for me for that way. And I was probably good for Brad a little bit. Like, he had somebody else to talk to. But it was nice that he kind of helped me. You know, like, just get settled. You know, like... Even Brad was like, go teach this improv group I'm coaching. He's like, it'll make you feel normal for a little while. I know you don't know him, so I would go with him. I did a couple times to watch him coach a team. I don't know why, but I did. But it made me feel normal.
Brad is like one of the nicest, most level-headed people who really understands. Not only he's a great performer, he understands the business part of it.
Yeah, he's super smart about that. And he knows everybody.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing. In Chicago, he knows everybody. In L.A., he knows everybody. Mm-hmm.
What is the difference of L.A. versus Chicago in terms of the improv? You've performed in Chicago. You performed in L.A. We talked a little about it.
I think improv in Chicago is improv for improv's sake. And I think in L.A. it's improv for another reason, whether it's get on your resume, for acting... There's a lot of good improvisers in L.A., but there's also a lot of bad improvisers in L.A. I assume just like Chicago, but you can tell the people that are from Chicago. I can tell because they're better. They're just better. I mean, I hate saying it. There's a lot of good old L.A. improvisers and young L.A. improvisers, but I'm always biased to the Chicago people.
We had a question from someone, and I want to end with this. The question was, what made People of Earth such a great team?
I think it was because it was my family. You know, for like that first year, where I was so lonely, and I moved up here waiting for my friend over, but outside I didn't know anybody. So like, I think those guys are. That is, you know, that's my Chicago family, and then so like those that's the most important thing I think, and I think that's what makes those shows really good. It's like watching a bunch of like brothers jump, you know, like why is Andy hitting Danny? Why is Danny saying that? Like that's what makes it fun. Or that, you know, why is Rush and
Rush Howell, and Alex Hendrick?
Yeah, and like so family, and you know, we were a huge gang. You know, we could fuck with each other, but nobody could come and fuck with us, because then we'd all have to turn around and fight them. That's all we had, too. That's all we had. So,
could that happen today, still?
Yeah, I think so. But it's harder, because I think that there's so many more opportunities here now, with like little theater.
Because when you said that was the only thing, today everybody's doing 10 different things, and with you guys, that was it. Well, you were on the Improv Island.
Yeah, because Annoyance was still on Clark Street, and it had just closed. Mm-hmm. Like, it was about to close, so that place was going away. None of us were doing Second City, and Second City didn't have all the shit they have there now to do little shows. I think the Playground was around a little bit, But we got on such an IO after one or two levels, we just stuck. That was where we got to do stuff. You know.
Andy Sinclair, thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you.
And there you have it, another episode of Improv Nerd. I want to thank our very special guest today, Andy St. Clair. And as always, the good people here at Stage 773 in Chicago, our home base, and our producer, Ben Comprero. As you know, we have a sponsor, and that sponsor is Hotel Lincoln here in Chicago, a wonderful hotel located in the heart of Lincoln Park, and it's just a walk away from Second City and a cab ride away from any of the Northside improv institutions. So check that out. If you need a place to stay, go to the Hotel Lincoln. It's so super funky and fun. I think you'll really enjoy it. If you need any more information about Improv Nerd or my award-winning classes, The Artist Low Comedy, or my Improv Nerd blog, go to jimmycorain.com. And if you're home or at work and you got nothing to do, you're surfing the net, go to the Improv Nerd Fanbook Facebook page and like us. It really helps with my low self-esteem. And as always, thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Let's say Seinfeld was on an island, and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
It might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I love having you